Good morning and welcome to our podcast. I'm David Pritchard, Head of Marketing here at Sintons. Joined today by my colleagues Hannah Mitchell, who is a solicitor in the Corporate Protection Team here at Sintons, and also Ify Archibong, who is a solicitor in our Family Team, also here at Sintons. The podcast, which will last approximately 20 to 25 minutes, is going to concentrate on capacity in family proceedings. So without any further ado, I'm going to pass you straight over to Hannah. Hannah, good morning and over to you.
Thanks, David. So Ify, yeah, we thought it would be good to have a discussion about capacity in family proceedings, specifically what happens if somebody lacks capacity but needs to go through divorce proceedings. And I think a good place to start before we do go into the issues of capacity and divorce proceedings is to start right at the start of the relationship in terms of what the capacity test is to marry. Are you able to talk about that?
Yes, that's a really good starting point. So it is quite a low threshold. And, you know, I think quite a leading case on this issue is that of Mundell and Number One. And by way of a background, the case involved a 28-year-old man who we'll refer to as P. And he announced his plans to marry his partner of 3 years. His deputy had applied to the Court of Protection for a declaration that P did not have the mental capacity to do so. So Adrian Mundell, who was his deputy, had been appointed after P had been awarded with quite a substantial sum of compensation following a car accident. And P had experienced learning difficulties since he was a child, and Mundell was appointed to help him manage his finances following that injury. So in terms of the verdict in that case, the court determined that P should be able to marry, citing Article 12 of the European Convention of Human Rights. Essentially, this maintains that the right to form a marriage has been in play in our society since the very dawn of time. So the court's view was setting the degree of capacity needed to marry unnecessarily high could potentially encroach on this basic human right. So some key principles that came out of this case, which now really are kind of the legal test in terms of the capacity to marry, are firstly that marriage is status specific and not person specific. Secondly, that a person getting married must understand the broad nature of the marriage contract. And finally, that a person getting married must understand the duties and responsibilities that normally attach to marriage, including that there may be financial consequences on divorce, and that spouses have a particular status and connection with regard to each other.
So the threshold for capacity to get married is quite low compared to some other decisions that you might make in life.
Yes, exactly.
If there is a relationship breakdown following marriage and the parties are looking to get divorced, what is the threshold for capacity with regards to divorce?
So there isn't as much guidance on this point, but there is again another case called Calvert that was dealt with in 1999, which essentially states that separation requires the lowest level of understanding. So divorce requires a bit more understanding, but requires the same level of capacity as marriage. So capacity to understand financial and legal issues is higher on the competence hierarchy. So I think it's important, if in doubt, to obtain an assessment of capacity. Who would you recommend for this, Anna?
So if you're looking to get a capacity assessment of somebody's capacity to enter into marriage or divorce proceedings, I would recommend that you instruct a medical or a social care professional. This is generally who the Court of Protection would require to do the assessment. So it might be like a GP or a social worker, and we would recommend that it's somebody who already knows the person well, if that's possible. It's worth noting that GPs more and more aren't doing capacity assessments. It might be that you need to instruct a psychiatrist or a psychologist, and there'll be a fee payable for them conducting that assessment.
So if once you have this capacity assessment and it states that there's no capacity, how can they then navigate the divorce proceedings?
So if you've got a capacity assessment that says the person lacks capacity to enter into divorce proceedings themselves, you're really looking to appoint somebody else to act on their behalf and make decisions in their best interests. Usually this will be by way of a litigation friend. This is somebody who is appointed to make decisions about the court case on behalf of the protected party, known as P, who isn't able to manage their own affairs or make decisions for themselves due to injury or illness. So anybody who can act fairly and competently in the best interests of the protected party can act as a litigation friend. So it might be their parent or guardian, friend, family member. It can be a professional such as a solicitor, could be a professional deputy or a lay deputy or an attorney under a lasting power of attorney. So there's lots of options there. If there is nobody who is willing or suitable for the role, then you can appoint the official solicitor, provided that there is evidence of a lack of capacity and funds available to pay the fees. So if you are looking to be litigation friend for somebody who lacks capacity to litigate, you can be expecting to have to sign legal documents, attend court hearings, take legal advice, give instructions to solicitors, keep the protected party updated about what's going on, make decisions about the case, for example, whether to accept a settlement offer. And any decisions that you're making on behalf of the other person must be in their best interests at all times. And then your role as litigation friend would end either on the conclusion of the case or if earlier, if the protected party regains capacity to make decisions for themselves. I think it's also worth noting as well that if you're acting as attorney or deputy for somebody who lacks capacity to litigate, then you can't go ahead unless you've got the relevant authority to litigate on behalf of that person. We'll talk about that in a little bit, but it's just worth pointing out for now. In terms of divorce proceedings and wider family law, can you use a litigation friend for all areas of family law, or is there certain areas where you can't instruct someone on your behalf?
You can use a litigation friend in all areas of family law, and that would include during the divorce process, in the separation of the finances upon divorce, and also in relation to issues relating to children. So issues which go before the court, providing that you follow the appropriate steps required to become a litigation friend, then it is fine for them to be involved during the family court process.
Mm-hmm. And if you decided that you wanted to be a litigation friend in family proceedings, how would you go about doing that?
So there are two ways that you can go about doing this. Firstly, you could provide a copy of the court order appointing you as deputy. If this provides that you have permission to act as their litigation friend, or by filling out a certificate of suitability if you are not the person's deputy. So it's important to note that the court order or the certificate of suitability must be sent to court before you can actually act for this protected party. The second way is that you can actually be appointed by the court. So anyone involved in the case can ask the court to get a litigation friend appointed at any time during the case. And it's important that you complete the relevant forms. I believe it's called the FP2.
I think it's worth adding as well that the process is different for attorneys or deputies.
Okay.
If you are an attorney or a deputy for somebody who lacks capacity to litigate, then the court will want to see the lasting power or the court order appointing you to check that there's nothing in there that would prevent you from acting. So the process to be appointed as a litigation friend really depends on what authority you have and whether you need to make a further application to court for authority to litigate. So, for example, if you are a deputy and you have a deputy order, generally, it will say that you have authority to make decisions about their property or finances, but that you don't have authority to litigate without making a further application to the Court of Protection. Alternatively, there might be instances where you have a court order that says that you do have authority to litigate, in which case you don't need to make that further application. Alternatively, you might be in a position where there's no deputy, in which case you're looking to file the certificate of suitability that you've just talked about. And that's also the case for attorneys, a slightly different process there. They can be appointed either by an order from the Court of Protection or by following the process of the certificate of suitability or by obtaining an order from the court in the substantive proceedings. So lots of different routes, really dependent on what authority you have and what role you're acting in. And because it's so complex, we would recommend that you do get legal advice if you are looking to be acting as somebody's litigation friend in any proceedings, just because it is a bit of a complex process and you need to understand what you're doing. In terms of the divorce proceedings, Ify, what decisions is the litigation firm going to have to make on behalf of the protected party?
That's a really good question. I think when we're looking at divorce proceedings, you kind of split them into two areas that are very much connected. You've got the actual divorce process itself, and then you've got the separation of the finances upon divorce. So the divorce process itself is very much streamlined now, and there's been quite a lot of significant changes to the process since last year. It's now completed online. It now takes a minimum of 6 months for the divorce process to be completed. And there are a number of stages which the litigation firm would need to assist with. It will really depend on whether the protected party is initiating the divorce proceedings, the divorce process, or responding to an application that has already been made. So the stages really are that the initial application would be made, an acknowledgement of service would then be filed in response. And then there is a cooling off period of around 5 months, after which a conditional order can be applied for. And then thereafter, the final order can be sought, which will formally end the marriage. It's also important to note that you can do this process jointly now as well. So it's quite an interesting point to note. So the other area is in relation to the finances. So when you enter into a divorce, the financial side of things also needs to be severed. The way that this is done is by way of a financial consent order, which is agreed by parties and sent to court for a formal approval. The protected party will need assistance with this. So essentially understanding the document and negotiating what can be agreed and what can't be agreed. If the consent order cannot be agreed, then one of the parties can issue proceedings for the court to deal with the issue of separating the finances. And the court would normally list the case to be considered. There's usually three hearings which take place. And at each stage of those hearings, it is hoped that the parties would try to reach an agreement on how the finances should be split upon divorce. The last hearing essentially is where parties may be required to give evidence depending on the complexity of the case, and the protected party may need to give evidence. They will need to be supported through this process by their litigation friend. And the court can make further directions in the form of what's called special measures to assist the protected party in giving their best evidence. For example, they may have the chance to have more breaks during their evidence.
So you mentioned that there's two elements to this, the divorce aspect on the one hand, and then also the financial side of things. I think it's worth adding that capacity itself is time and decision specific. So somebody might have capacity to make some decisions, but not others. For example, I've got a client who has been assessed as having capacity to understand the divorce and what that involves and instruct a solicitor to deal with the divorce. However, they lack capacity to understand the more complex financial proceedings and to give disclosure of evidence and understand what a settlement offer would look like. In addition to that, it's important not to confuse a lack of understanding with a lack of capacity, because divorce proceedings, I'm sure, can be very complex. I mean, I would struggle to understand the process, I'm sure. So just because somebody doesn't understand the process doesn't mean that they lack capacity to make decisions if that process is carefully explained to them. So if there is doubts about whether the protected party has a lack of understanding or a lack of capacity, or whether they can make decisions in relation to some of the process but not others, we recommend that they get a capacity assessment done just to identify exactly what they might be able to make decisions for themselves and where they might need a bit of support from a litigation friend. I mentioned there about an offer for settlement. What does that look like? What would the litigation friend be looking for in terms of the settlement offer?
It's really difficult to predict. It really is dealt with on a case-by-case basis. And there really isn't a standard formula for how the finances should be split. Things are really dealt with as if they were before the court, and the court would consider a number of factors in trying to determine how the finances should be split. Those factors include the ages of the parties, the length of the cohabitation, and any children that they may have. And we would usually advise as well that parties should get full disclosure so that there is a good idea of what is within the matrimonial pot, and the litigation friend should assist with this. Further, once the court order has been finalised, it's important that the protected party has some assistance in relation to understanding this and what is required, as well as the negotiation of that order also.
So you mentioned that the court will take a number of factors when considering how to divide up the finances. Does the court give any consideration to one of the parties having diminished capacity? For example, a lot of my clients have received big compensation awards due to injury. Is that something the court would take into account?
Yes, the court would take into account. I mean, I think this is sort of going to a little bit more of a complex area in terms of how the matrimonial pot would be split. If you've said, for example, clients have received compensation as a result of injury, there may be various arguments there in relation to whether those are classed as matrimonial assets or non-matrimonial assets. But I think in such complex cases like that, it's really important to obtain some legal advice, because those are quite intricate issues that need to be dealt with. I do think that in terms of a protected party and further assistance that they may need following a divorce and separation, it may be that they could argue that they require a larger split of the matrimonial pot, given that, you know, they do require the further assistance and the help.
You know, I suppose adapted properties and things like that.
Exactly.
In terms of funding for the application, so if you've got the application to be a litigation friend and then, you know, the legal proceedings themselves, there's also a question about legal aid. Are you able to advise on the funding for the process?
So my understanding is that the actual application to be a litigation friend, there isn't a cost associated with that, but there are other costs within the proceedings that the litigation friend would need to think about. So the actual application for the divorce, I believe it's £593. There may be a discussion about whether the parties can split that fee. It will really depend on how amicable the parties are, but that fee does need to be met. There are other fees, such as from a financial point of view, if financial consent order is agreed, then there is an additional fee for submitting that financial consent order for approval by the court. But there are other costs. So, for example, if financial remedy proceedings are initiated, it's difficult to predict, but there may be quite significant costs associated with that if the protected party does have legal assistance. But also it really depends on how the proceedings progress in terms of the significance of those costs. It is possible to obtain legal aid funding. I believe it is if you have been the victim of domestic abuse, you may be able to access that funding. But I believe there are also exceptional case funding options that are available as well. Sintons don't provide legal aid funding, so our advice would usually be that the individual makes those inquiries as to whether they would be eligible for legal aid funding independently. But there are costs which are associated with the process that the litigation friend would need to think about. So one of the things that I think would be quite important is what happens if there is a conflict.
So when you're applying to be litigation friend on behalf of a party who lacks capacity to litigate, the question really is whether you're suitable and willing to act in the role, and whether you can act in that person's best interests. If there's any doubt about that, the court would not want you to be acting as a litigation friend, and they would suggest that you appoint an alternative. So, for example, if you were proposing to act as a litigation friend for a spouse and there had been a history of domestic abuse, you know, there's a risk there that you wouldn't be acting in their best interests, and that the protected party wouldn't want you making decisions for them. Similarly, I came across a case where the litigation friend had a child with the protected party, and so there was a question about whether they could act in the person's best interests if the outcome of the case would have an impact on the child. So if there is any doubt about whether you're able to act in the person's best interests, it might be a case of looking for whether there's a solicitor or a family member who could act instead. And as I said earlier, if there's nobody who's suitable or willing to act as litigation friend, then as a last resort, you can ask the official solicitor to act as litigation friend. They have a number of requirements that need to be met before they would agree to act as litigation friend. For example, that they are a last resort, that there's nobody else able, suitable and willing to act, and also that there's evidence of lack of capacity on behalf of the protected party, and that there's funds available to pay for the legal costs in them acting. So if we just conclude, if somebody was thinking of acting as litigation friend within family proceedings, what advice would you give them?
I think first and foremost, it's really important that they follow the correct procedure in relation to how to become a litigation friend, as we've stated above. It's important that they check the requirements for this. But also, I think another crucial point is that they remember that the priorities, they need to act in the best interests of the protected party. It can be difficult to be independent, but it is important that the litigation friend sets their feelings aside and any interests that they may have and make sure that the focus is on the protected party.
Yeah, and I would just add that, you know, if you're not acting in their best interest and carrying out your duties properly, then you can be replaced or removed by the court. So it is best to take the time to really think about whether it's something you want to do before you apply to act as someone's litigation friend. I think that's it from us, so we'll hand back to you, David.
Thanks very much to both of you. Enjoyed listening to that one. Just as I say at the end of each of these podcasts, we continue to work hard to produce, release and deliver useful and relevant content, articles, podcasts, blogs, all of which can be found on our website, www.sintons.co.uk, should you wish to take a look. You can also follow the teams on Twitter, at Sintons Family, at Sintons Cop, and for the family team on Instagram, also at Sintons Family. Just in terms of contact details, you can get in touch with both of our speakers if you'd like to discuss anything they've raised today, or indeed in any of the podcasts, 091226 7878 for Hannah, hannah.mitchell@sintons.co.uk for her email, and for Iffy, iffy.archibong@sintons.co.uk. That's it from us today. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe, everyone, and we'll speak to you next time. Thank you.